And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, November 5th. I encourage you to have a pencil and paper handy because you might want to take down names, addresses, telephone numbers, or other information to help you take action on the news that you hear. Let's start with announcements. The Everglades Earth First announces a week of resistance, November 27th through December 5th, from the Earth First Newswire. Everglades Earth First is excited to host a week of resistance starting Friday, February 27th, ending with a mass demonstration organized by the Palm Beach County Environmental Coalition on Saturday, December 5th. Join us as we continue the Scrap Scripps Save the Bridger Forest campaign. Resist corporations on the Everglades bioregion that destroy wild spaces to bring upscale housing and biotechnology, including animal testing laboratories. During this week, we will focus on cross-movement building across South Florida in addition to working on our forest defense campaign. As of now, we have dates set with the South Florida SMASH HLS, an animal liberation group based out of Miami that is fighting monkey-torturing company Worldwide Primates, and Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs, who share vegan and vegetarian food publicly to protest war and poverty. Details such as accommodations and schedule will be made available to those who register and are accepted to participate in the week with us. We will be accepting applications from now until November 26th. Please register by going to the website www.EvergladesEarthFirst.net. That webpage again, www.EvergladesEarthFirst.net for the Earth First Everglades Week of Resistance, November 27th through December 5th. And the California Fish and Game Commission has delayed the opening of the Dungeness and rock crab season. The California Fish and Game Commission today voted 3-0 in favor of an emergency rulemaking to prohibit the recreational take and possession of Dungeness crab and all rock crab from ocean waters, including bays and estuaries, north of the Ventura-Santa Barbara County line. Closure of the fisheries will remain in effect until the director of the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment in California, in consultation with the California Department of Public Health, determines that domoic acid levels no longer pose a significant risk to public health and no longer recommends the fisheries be closed. The commission also directed the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to maintain a list of closed ocean waters of the state and update that list on Wednesday of each week at 1 p.m. It shall be the responsibility of any person prior to taking Dungeness crab to call the department's hotline at 831-649-2883. That hotline again, 831-649-2883, or visit the department's website at www.wildlife.ca.gov to obtain the current status of any ocean waters. The recreational Dungeness crab season was scheduled to begin Saturday, November 7th. California Department of Public Health, in conjunction with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, has been actively testing crabs since early September, and the results from the most recent tests showed that the health risk to humans is significant. California Department of Public Health issued a health advisory on Tuesday, and the recommendation was made for delays and closure of the crab season. California Department of Fish and Wildlife will continue to coordinate with other California agencies to test domoic acid levels in crabs along the coast to determine when the fishery can be safely opened. Domoic acid is a potent neurotoxin that can accumulate in shellfish, other invertebrates, and sometimes fish. It causes illness and sometimes death in a variety of birds and marine mammals that consume affected organisms. At low levels, domoic acid exposure can cause nausea, diarrhea, and dizziness in humans. At higher level, it can cause persistent short-term memory loss, seizures, and in some cases can be fatal. Domoic acid is produced from some species of the marine diatom Pseudonyxia. Currently, a massive toxic bloom of the yellow diatom has developed, significantly impacting marine life along California's coast. Biologists tested crab from 8 ports from Morro Bay to Crescent City and determined that domoic acid levels are exceeding the state's action level. Algal blooms are common, but this one is particularly large and persistent. Warmer ocean water temperatures due to the El Niño event California is experiencing are likely to cause the size and persistence of this bloom. Commercial fisheries are also affected by domoic acid levels. California Department of Fish and Wildlife has authority to delay or otherwise restrict commercial fisheries and is developing an emergency rulemaking under that authority. The commercial Dungeness crab season is currently slated to open November 15th. And here, unfortunately, is in memoriam Susan Tixier, founder of Great Old Broads for Wilderness, in this story from Californians for Western Wilderness. It was very sad news for the wilderness community in the West this month when Susan Tixier passed away. Despite being best known as the founder of the Great Old Broads for Wilderness, Susan had a long history of involvement in conservation organizations, including the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, the Colorado Environmental Coalition, Forest Guardians, the Land and Water Fund of the Rockies, and the New Mexico Environmental Legal Center. She and a group of older women started Great Old Broads as a response to Utah Senator Orrin Hatch's assertion in opposition to wilderness designation that if for no other reason we need roads for the aged and the infirm. They decided to show him that older people loved being outdoors and don't need roads to go everywhere. In an article on senior activism in the AARP magazine, Susan Tixier was quoted, "It is our calling to spread the word to great broads everywhere that the experience of waking up in your sleeping bag in the middle of a canyon country with two close yipping coyotes under a full moon, walking through rising rivers in the rain, seeking shelter from a late snowstorm under a ledge, standing quietly to watch mama bear and cubs cross the path in front of you, that these events are a living metaphor for how best to live our lives. Without the opportunity to experience wilderness, civilization becomes sterile, safe, and dead. Susan Tixier was a woman full of energy and a great friend to us all. We will miss her very much." And you can find out more information about Californians for Western Wilderness at www.caluwild.org. That's caluwild.org. And honoring Betty and Gary Ball with the 2015 Semper Virens Award recipients in this story by Nataline DeLapp of the Environmental Protection Information Center. Betty Ball and her late husband Gary Ball will receive the 2015 Semper Virens Lifetime Achievement Award at EPIC's 38th Annual Fall Celebration tomorrow, Friday, November 6th. Betty and Gary are the founders of the Mendocino Environmental Center, which became the hub for environmental and political activism in Mendocino and Humboldt counties for more than a decade between 1987 and 1997. The issues in those years included abuse of forests on private lands, the Forest Forever Ballot Initiative, Redwood Summer, and the campaign to protect the Headwaters Forest. Betty, the consummate networker and organizer, was indispensable to the efforts to protect the environment of Northern California. Originally from Boulder, Colorado, Betty and Gary came to the Sinkione Coast in 1986 to visit friends and fell in love with the region. Upon learning that the timber company Georgia Pacific was in pursuit of logging coastal ancient redwoods in the Sinkione area, they were spurred into action. Having long had fantasies about starting an environmental center where people could come and gather, work, and cooperatively share resources, when Betty and Gary relocated to Ukiah in 1987, they were able to open the Mendocino Environmental Center, lovingly called the MEC, with little more than a $20 donation, a storefront office, and a phone line. Very quickly, the MEC became the central network for activism, with Betty becoming the connector between local and regional groups. Working with and bringing together activists such as Judy Berry, Daryl Cherney, Betty and Gary showed the way to organize the community. It was those connections that were instrumental in building the movement to protect the natural communities of Northern California. Gary Ball and Judy Berry used to collaborate on articles. One about the economic and environmental implications of militarism was called Ground Beef to Ground War, which connected military intervention and destroying El Salvadorian forests for the fast food industry. To spread awareness of the issue, the activists marched through Ukiah with papier-mâché animal heads, singing songs, and drumming. "The protest was all over the Ukiah Daily Journal," said Betty. "It was probably the most outlandish thing that Ukiah had ever seen." Another early campaign that stands out for Betty was the effort to protect Trout Creek. Pacific Gas and Electric had a logging plan to log Trout Creek in the Potter Valley area outside of Ukiah. Activists developed a brilliant and highly effective strategy. They created postcards and distributed them liberally to people up and down the coast. Those postcards were sent to PG&E, telling them that everyone was going to withhold money from each bill until the company agreed not to log Trout Creek, said Betty. PG&E was flooded with postcards, and that led the utility company to being amenable to negotiations, and because of those efforts, Trout Creek timber is standing today. In the late 1980s, Maxam Pacific Lumber's efforts to liquidate one of the largest remaining tracts of old-growth redwood was in full swing in Humboldt County. Activists all across the state were working to bring attention to the issue. Groups such as the Environmental Protection Information Center were filing lawsuits. There was direct action and organized protests coming out of the MEC. In 1989, the Mendocino Environmental Center, EPIC, and other grassroots organizations such as Earth First decided to explore the California ballot initiative process as a means to protect private forests, specifically headwaters. To pursue this, activists formed a new organization called Forest Forever and began creating a ballot initiative of the same name. Proposition 130 would have been the strictest forest regulations anywhere. It would have restricted logging along stream beds, mandated canopy cover, and no old-growth logging at all, said Betty Ball. The timber companies were going nuts about it. They knew it would mean in terms of their ability to reap their fortunes, so they upped their harvesting. Tensions between environmentalists and loggers were reaching a climax. Betty and Gary Ball organized meetings between loggers, middle management, and environmentalists to try and calm down the tensions. Gary and Betty were incredible peacemakers, said Naomi Wagner. They mediated many stressful situations that helped to de-escalate conflicts. Simultaneously, the organizing of Redwood Summer was underway. Modeled after Mississippi Summer, Redwood Summer was a statewide and national effort to draw attention to headwaters. Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney, with the support of the MEC, traveled to colleges and universities to spread information and get people involved. The MEC helped establish base camps so that people had places to stay, food to eat, and would be able to plug into actions. On May 24, 1990, Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney were driving from Oakland, California to Santa Cruz when a pipe bomb exploded directly under Berry's driver's side seat. Daryl was only slightly injured, but Judy was impaled and had to be removed with the jaws of death, said Betty. I received a call at the MEC, but I didn't believe it because there had been so many other pranks and threats that I didn't believe the story. I thought, this has to be a hoax, but it wasn't a hoax. Both Daryl and Judy were arrested for bombing themselves. After the bombing happened, it made some of the loggers wonder, said Betty. We had to convince people that Judy and Daryl weren't the perpetrators, but instead the victims. It was horrible not to have Judy present, but Redwood Summer still happened. The tragedy caused the movement to grow bigger. People were so incensed by what happened that it galvanized the movement. People stood in solidarity with Judy and Daryl, said Betty. The charges were never dropped, but eventually the FBI and the Oakland Police Department were forced to pay $4 million in a civil and constitutional lawsuit. The FBI and the Oakland Police Department were found guilty of violating Judy and Daryl's civil rights, which helped preserve the rights of activists everywhere. Meanwhile, the timber industry used the bombing as a media tool to say, this proposition was brought forward by Earth First, said Betty. In November 1990, Proposition 130 narrowly lost after garnering 48.5% of the vote. As an organizing hub, the Mendocino Environmental Center used educational outreach, litigation, legislation, and direct action to accomplish its goals. It is because of Betty's and Gary's efforts that Northern California has a strong culture of activism and protected forests, and because of their lifetime of work, it is the pleasure of the Environmental Protection Information Center to present the 2015 Semper Virens Award to Betty and Gary Ball of the Mendocino Environmental Center. Without Betty and Gary, we would have not saved Headwaters Forest. Thanks to the MEC and its incredible networking, said Naomi Wagner. And you can find out more information at www.wildcalifornia.org. That's www.wildcalifornia.org. And the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. While Buffalo Field Campaign is headquartered in West Yellowstone, some of our most difficult and crucial field patrols take place in the Gardner Basin, along Yellowstone's northern boundary. During the past decade of the heaviest bison migrations, and consequently the worst slaughter and hunting operations, have been taking place along Yellowstone's northern boundary, requiring that we keep a strong presence in both places at once. Last year alone, more than 500 bison were killed in the northern boundary area of Yellowstone National Park. In the Gardner Basin, buffalo are very vulnerable. The landscape is wide open, making the animals easier for hunters to find and access from roadways. And when they do seek the safety of the park's boundaries, they meet another face of death, Yellowstone's Stevens Creek bison trap, from where thousands of wild bison have been sent to slaughter in recent years. Unlike West Yellowstone, where we have our own property and cabin, we must rent our place in Gardner, where there is a housing shortage and rental properties are few, far between, and very expensive. We recently learned that the space we have called home for the past two seasons is being turned into a youth hostel and is no longer available. Our continued presence in Gardner is essential to our ongoing efforts to protect the buffalo and document every action taken against them. After a long and exhaustive search, we were very fortunate to have found a new place, although it will cost us $1,100 a month, nearly double what we paid last year. As someone who cares about wild buffalo and keeps informed through Buffalo Field Campaign's field reports, we know how important our patrols are. We are reaching out to all of you to help in covering our substantial and unexpected expense. Please make a contribution right now so we can keep our focus on the buffalo where it belongs. And you can stand with the buffalo. Frontline's volunteers are needed for this field season. Buffalo Field Campaign has seasonal openings for field volunteers. We have opportunities in every season, but we are in great need of folks during our field season, which runs from November through May. This is the time of year when wild bison are migrating into Montana and facing death and harassment. Any buffalo within Montana's borders is in danger of being shot on sight, hazed, or captured and shipped to the slaughterhouse. All volunteers are provided room, board, gear, and training in exchange for staffing our field patrols. We do cater to almost any dietary need, including roadkill. We are located in a warm log cabin by beautiful Hebgen Lake, just a few miles outside of West Yellowstone, Montana, and we also run a camp north of Yellowstone in the Gardner Basin. Please visit our website to learn more about being a field volunteer and make your plans to come to Montana. We want to see you on the front lines. For more information, go to their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. That's www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. If you'd like to send that big donation to help them cover their rental costs, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Once again, that address, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you have any questions about this or any other aspect of the Buffalo Field Campaign, give them a call. Area code 406-646-0070. Once again, 406-646-0070. And you can find all this information and more at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And there's been a win up in the Alaskan Tongass National Forest. The Forest Service has withdrawn the Mitkoff Island old-growth timber sale in this story from Cascadia Wild. In a federal court ruling last Friday, the U.S. Forest Service announced it will withdraw its decision on the Mitkoff Island project, a large 35 million board feet timber sale. The project is in the center of the Tongass National Forest near the communities of Petersburg and Kaprianov. Petersburg District Ranger Jason Anderson signed the Forest Service's decision in March. In May, five environmental organizations filed the lawsuit, GSACC versus Anderson. They are the Greater Southeast Asian Conservation Community, Cascadia Wildlands, the Center for Biological Diversity, Greenpeace, and the Alaskan Wildlife Alliance. Faced with the realities brought forth in our lawsuit, the Forest Service is withdrawing the Mitkoff Project rather than defend it in court. This is a legal victory for old growth, wildlife, and subsistence hunters, although we don't know whether the agency will attempt to resurrect the project with future planning, said Cordova-based Gabriel Scott of Cascadia Wildlands. At issue in the lawsuit is the harm caused by logging old growth and to the species dependent on old growth forests, including Sitka black-tailed deer an essential resource for subsistence hunters, the Alexander Archipelago wolf and the Queen Charlotte goshawk. Petersburg resident Becky Knight of GSACC said Mitkoff Island has been hard hit by 60 years of industrial logging. Subsistence hunters from the community rely on deer as a primary source of protein, but for years they have been faced with critically low deer populations and severe harvest restrictions. This area of the Tongass needs a long period of recovery, but this sale targeted some of the few remaining stands of important winter deer habitat. Randy Spivak of the Center for Biological Diversity said that during the planning process for this sale, the Forest Service tried to downplay and hide from the public the full scope of the damage this logging would cause. Spivak added, the agency initially told the public this was a small sale involving only a local logging opportunities, but the project ballooned to a major timber sale designed for a large regional or out-of-state timber operator. The Forest Service must take a hard look at the environmental consequences of its actions, especially with respect to species like the deer and goshawk that depend on old-growth forests, said Oliver Stifel of the Crag Law Center. In a rush to approve yet another major old-growth timber sale, the Tongass National Forest brushed aside these environmental concerns and fast-tracked the project. In the court ruling, the Forest Service asked for an extension of the briefing schedule and in the case to give the agency time to formalize its withdrawal notice. The extension request was for 60 days. If you'd like further information, go to www.cascwild.org. That's cascwild.org. And a lone activist has liberated foxes and rabbits from a Wisconsin fur farm in this story from the North American Animal Liberation Press Office, as found on the Earth First Newswire. This story was received anonymously. In the early hours of October 23, 2015, I took a pair of bolt cutters to the back fence of the fox farm on Hospital Road in Burlington, Wisconsin. The first imprisoned animal found was a 20-pound rabbit in a small wire-bottom cage. She was either a neglected pet or a source of food. I did not have the resources to bring her with me and released her into the field behind the property. It was a difficult decision, but at least she spent some time of her life hopping free and feeling the earth beneath her feet before meeting her fate. There were only two foxes found on the property. They were tall, beautiful, and black with glowing eyes. I crawled into one of their cages in an attempt to pull one out, but she only growled and retreated. They would only come out if I backed away and watched from afar, but as soon as they were out of their cages, they joyously galloped around in circles. It was the most beautiful thing to see. I did not wait to see if they made it through the holes in the three layers of fencing that kept them imprisoned. Raiding a fur farm can be easily done by a single person with enough courage and the love to do so. I'm sorry this raid was not more fruitful. This action is in solidarity with Walter Bond. Fool though he may be, Walter is a hero for animals and a comrade who is not to be forgotten. Quote, life shrinks or expands in proportion to one's courage, unquote. Anais Nin. And the agency has floated a recovery plan for Oregon coho salmon in this story by Gosia Wozniacka, the Associated Press. A federal agency has received a roadmap for the recovery of threatened Oregon coast coho salmon. The draft plan from the National Marine Fisheries Service focuses on protecting and restoring freshwater habitats that have a mixture of freshwater and saltwater, including streams, lakes, and wetlands. The plan also calls on the state to strengthen regulations on activities such as agriculture and logging to protect water quality and habitat. The Oregon coast coho was first listed under the U.S. Endangered Species Act in 1998. It was later taken off that list, but litigation forced the government to grant it federal protections again in 2008. The listing was retained until 2011, and in 2015 a federal review found that while aspects of the species status have improved, the species still needs protection. In July, two environmental groups sued the federal agency over its failure to write a recovery plan in a timely manner. Between 1 and 2 million coho salmon once returned annually to the Oregon coast, but the number plummeted to around 20,000 in the 1990s because of overfishing, the loss of habitat, the effects of hatchery fish, among other factors. In recent years, improvements have led to increased coho numbers. Annual returns now range in the 100 to 350,000 fish. But federal biologists say poor ocean conditions and climate change could pose a challenge for coho. The main threats to overcoming that challenge, according to the plan, are degraded habitat and inadequate state rules. The loss of stream habitat for rearing of juvenile coho salmon is a big concern. This habitat, according to the plan, is critical to produce enough surviving juveniles to sustain the coho populations, especially during poor ocean conditions. Stream habitat includes large wood pools, connections to side channels and off-channel alcoves, wetlands, and backwater areas. A large part of the land with critical coho habitat lies on private land, including farmland and timberland. Because the plan is only a blueprint, its implementation will rely on the efforts of local jurisdictions, farmers, timber companies, and other private citizens. State agencies such as the Oregon Board of Forestry, which regulates logging buffers near streams, and the Department of Agriculture, which regulates pesticide spraying, will also play a large role, said Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director with the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the two groups that sued this past summer. We need bigger buffers around streams where chemicals aren't sprayed. We need larger logging buffers, Greenwald said. Greenwald praised the plan for its focus on habitat restoration and strengthening laws to protect the habitat. The big concern, he said, is whether the state of Oregon will step up and do what's necessary to have healthy salmon. NOAA Fisheries estimates the cost of recovery at about $55 million over the next 5 years and about $110 million to achieve full recovery, depending on the effectiveness of improvements to the coho salmon's habitat and the strength of laws protecting that habitat. The draft plan is open for public comment. For the next 60 days, the agency plans to issue a final recovery plan in 2016. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have this week for the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can listen into Free Radio tomorrow at 3 p.m. That's 3 p.m. on Friday afternoons for a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update. If you're in Moscow, Idaho, you can tune in to KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, at about 1:15 on Wednesday afternoons after Democracy Now! And you can always go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced by Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.